Welcome to the Insightful Investor Podcast, a weekly series that seeks to share industry, investment, and market insights. We define insights as concepts that are counterintuitive, widely misunderstood, or underappreciated. In other words, unique ideas that you probably won't hear elsewhere. I'm Alex Shahidi, the host of the podcast and co-CIO of Evoke Advisors, one of the nation's leading investment advisory firms. Learn more about our show at insightfulinvestor.org. Today's guest is Gerard O'Reilly. Gerard is the co-CEO, co-CIO, and director of Dimensional Fund Advisors, or DFA, which manages over $700 billion now. Gerard, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Alex. It's a pleasure to chat with you today.
Likewise. Why don't we start from the beginning? What originally piqued your interest in investing?
I had originally, when I went to college, focused mainly on sciences, did theoretical physics, did aeronautical engineering, sciences like that. And when I was finishing up my PhD at Caltech, you know, I thought something different might be interesting, something new to learn about. Finances certainly would impact my life, but it also impact lots of other people's lives. And was kind of interested in getting more into that field from the perspective of how different types of mathematics or tools that I had learned could be applied to investing in that field. And I was lucky enough that there was a colleague of mine at Caltech who ended up working at Dimensional and came down to Dimensional for some interviews and met with Ken French and others on the research team and thought, this is an interesting firm in that they work on real-world problems, invest for people, but there's a very nice blend of academia. And so how do you take that academic knowledge and put it to life in real-world portfolios here and now? And that was very, very appealing to me. And so joined Dimensional back in 2004 and been here and happy ever since.
So you had this transition from rocket scientist to investor, which is relatively unique. Is there something about that background in data science that has helped you be successful at DFA?
Yeah, I think Dimensional is very much a data-driven organization. We go where the data leads. And the question is, what are the tools that you need to use the data to understand what the data can tell you, in particular, what market prices can tell you? Because ultimately, market prices, the prices of publicly traded stocks, bonds, options, other types of derivatives, are forecasts of the future. And the question is, what can you extract from those forecasts in a systematic way that allow you to build portfolios? So some of the tools that I had learned, you know, in undergrad and then doing a PhD were very, very helpful in that respect. I also think Dimensional has a very academic way of approaching problems. It's the right answer wins, and regardless of who came up with the right answer, right? So it's how do we get those best ideas and put them forward for our clients. And I think that really appeals to me and appeals to the type of training that I had before I came to Dimensional. So those kind of aspects of our culture are important. It's always about doing the right thing, but then you can always get a little bit better every day. The data leads you and teaches you on how to get better and how to apply the science, if you will, in real world investing. So I think that there's a lot of, I guess I would call them, helpful tools that you will learn as an engineer, as a mathematician for investing that can be used very well at Dimensional.
And in my experience, the markets are very good at humbling you as well. So you have a thesis, you have an approach, and you think you've got it right, and then you learn that you're missing something. And so, and I assume the physical sciences are similar in that way.
They're very similar in that way. I'd say the big difference, and I agree with you 100%, Alex, is that you've got to look at the data. Whatever your view about the world, and it might be a very plausible and very rational viewpoint, the data are really the ultimate test. Do you see it in the data in a robust fashion? And when you look at the physical sciences, it's similar, right? Can you construct experiments or do you see things in the data that then you can learn from and that maybe helps you build equations and build models to understand the physical phenomenon better? The difference, though, is that when it comes to the social sciences, that the predictions are far noisier And you don't get to run the experiment over and over and over and over again. You have limited data sets that you can learn so much from, but there's limits to what you can learn. So I think that the important difference is understanding the limitations of the tools when it comes to social sciences, and don't get overly confident in the ability of models to be able to handle every real-world situation. Flexibility is important. Human judgment is important. Understanding the data are important. But all of that has to kind of come together in what we call the art of the science. This clearly is demonstrably the right answer, which is often the case with the physical sciences and less often the case when it comes to the social sciences.
Yeah, the other big difference is market prices are impacted by the players, and the players adapt through time. They learn, they get smarter, and that can change a lot of relationships in the future that may have existed in the past.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the keys there, Alex, is to understand what you think is constant and steady through time, and then what changes over time. So some of the things that I think are constant and steady through time are that people generally demand some type of reward for taking on risk. They may not always get that reward, right? That's why it's risk, but they demand some type of compensation for bearing risk. And that is reflected in the prices that they're willing to pay for when they invest in a stock or a bond. And I think that's pretty constant over time. That kind of philosophy is very, very constant over time. And if you accept that, then it implies that where you see prices landing is kind of reflecting the aggregate expectation of investors, where they've landed on the benefits of diversification versus expected return of a particular security and how it might contribute to the overall portfolio. Then the question of things that change through time or market microstructure are the way information is shared among investors on the types of tools that investors have to express their views on the future. Those things change through time and you have to adapt too. Accounting practices can change through time. So there's certain things that I think are very much steady and constant over time. Uncertainty, demanding compensation for bearing uncertainty. But then the methods by which you go and implement strategies based on that insight, I think that can change certainly over time.
The other thing that's constant is investors can be emotional, right? There's exuberance, there's fear, and you can get market dislocations.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a very interesting topic because you will find it very challenging to identify if there's a market dislocation in real time, right? That's the trick. If you believe there are market dislocations, can you identify them in real time? And there's very little evidence that that can be systematically done well. But the counterpoint that I would present is that when you look at the behavior in nature of herds, for example, and there's a piece of information that impacts a part of the herd way over on the left, and the whole herd reacts even all the way over to the right. Well, there's something about that in evolution that's led to the greater survivorship of folks reacting to information, even if they're not right adjacent to that information. So the whole notion that markets overreact and underreact, I think that there's a lot of, I would call it, practical limitations to that, but then also theoretical limitations to it, in that you see a lot of those types of behaviors in nature that ultimately lead to a better chance of survival. So the fact that people react to news and react quickly doesn't necessarily mean that people overreact. They may be reacting appropriately. And that, I think, is the trick, because if you accept prices for what they are and you accept markets for what they are as forecasts of the future, then you can never tell if prices are right or wrong. But what the data do show us is that prices are generally fair. And that means that you can rely on them. There's no way to say that they're systematically biased up or biased down, that they overreact or underreact. There's very little evidence to be able to identify that because it requires a model. And every model has its flaws. So is your model wrong or are the prices wrong? So I'm not a big proponent of that way of thinking because I just don't think it's very helpful from an investment perspective. what I think is helpful from an investment perspective is asking the question, are markets working right here, right now? Are trades happening? Is price discovery happening? And if so, let me trust in market prices and figure out how I can control the things I can control to give myself a better investment experience.
It's very insightful what you just said, because in the heat of the moments when, let's say, investors are fearful, that fear may be justified. And it's only after the fact when or if prices reverse that we look back and say, oh, that was a market dislocation and overreaction. But you don't know that at the time, which is the point that you just made.
Yeah, you never know in real time if it's an overreaction or not. And hindsight is always 20/20. But what I can say is that if you have a longer investment horizon, you have discipline, you can stay the course, that generally improves your odds. What I can also say, and I think this is one of these truths that kind of goes through time, is that flexibility has value, and it has even more value in those times of distress. So that's either flexibility as an end investor to say, I don't need to consume as much this year, so let me put off some consumption till I see what happens with my investment portfolio and market, some flexibility there. Or it can be as you manage the portfolio, how do you implement the strategy? And flexibility has a lot of value, even in more so in times of distress. And so I think that's another kind of what I would call a truth of investing, that uncertainty is a fact of life. People demand compensation for bearing uncertainty. A great way to deal with uncertainty is remaining flexible. And that's true in your personal life, but it's also true in your investment life. And those are kind of truths that underpin a lot of how Dimensional approaches investing, building portfolios, and then trying to achieve the best outcome for our clients.
I guess that's the shock absorbers, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you can avoid trading when everyone else is trading, that's often a good thing. Or you can avoid, if the market has just declined by a lot and you can avoid selling right there and then and turning your paper losses into real losses, that's generally can be a good thing over time. So I think that these flexibility and ways of handling uncertainty, the shock absorbers, Alex, to your point, really makes the ride smoother. Even though we're all going down that same bumpy road, some people can probably deal with it better than others. And some investment strategies have better shock absorbers than others.
Are there any key learnings or experiences early in your career that helped shape the investment philosophy and your core tenets that you have today?
Yeah, for sure. When I first joined Dimensional, it was interesting. We were a smaller organization back then in 2004. And the research team was just a handful of people. And the way that I kind of learned was I was given projects on various different topics that the firm was working on, given some papers, go read these papers, go read this book in finance and come back with some answers or some solutions. And it was kind of an interesting way. You go, you talk to people, you try to understand better. But there was a few kind of projects that I remember that were particularly interesting that kind of shaped how I think about things. One, we had a trading project. We were looking at trading prices. And effectively, we had these data sets that were very, very large data sets and looking at prices in 45 different markets around the world, kind of terabytes of data because it's every price, every print. And looking for ways to say, could we, on the very short horizon, identify where prices would move over the next few seconds? And all of the experiments that we ran, and we ran many, kind of gave you the level of predictability that was always within the bid-offer spread. And we were kind of puzzled about this, and we had a kind of a conversation with Gene Fama, who's kind of been associated with Dimensional for a long time, Nobel Prize winner in economics. And he just looked at the experiments. He said, yep, markets are efficient even down to the microsecond. And it was kind of a very unique insight in that the level of predictability was within the bid-offer spread. And so, yes, there's some predictability, but it costs you more or an equal amount to exploit that predictability as what markets kind of are set up in the way that they trade. And it's just kind of that notion of profits will be pursued always to the point of where the costs kind of match up with the profits, and seeing that in real time, I think was pretty interesting. So that kind of gave some insights on just the power of markets, and they're really a primal source of information. And the question that we should also always ask ourselves is how to use that information. Another interesting one was working on some of the core equity type solutions. And they were done in the early 2000s, started a little bit before I joined Dimensional, and then started to roll out in 2004 when I had joined the firm. And those were really the original, I think, in some respects, multi-factor solutions, where we were taking an all-of-market strategy, deviating from market cap weights and blending value premiums with size premiums, and then subsequently incorporating momentum in a very systematic way and profitability in a systematic way and asset growth in a systematic way. And really there, the interesting lessons were around control what you can control. If I can get an asset allocation and do it with better diversification, lower turnover, lower costs, and a more consistent focus on various premiums in a more integrated way, I've controlled other things that I can't control. And that's ultimately going to be a better solution. So I think some of those lessons early on, just accepting market prices and controlling what you can control, were important lessons for me in how to build strategies, but then also later in my career, how to think about running the business and what types of things to emphasize when you're pursuing projects or trying to work out problems for clients and taking and listening to clients and saying, how can we build something that meets their needs? And I think that those are two good tenets to have in mind.
Let's talk about DFA for a second. It was founded in 1981, and the firm has been applying financial science to investing for over 40 years. Would you talk about the core principles that form DFA and the emphasis on rigorous academic research?
Yeah, and we've kind of touched on some of them already, Alex, but I'll reemphasize. One is that it all begins with the client. And when you look back at the firm's founding, David Booth and Rex Singfield and team, basically, they had been involved in indexing in the 70s, and they had been some of the first people to work on some of the first index funds. So they understood well some of the benefits of indexing over traditional active in terms of diversification, low cost, low turnover. And in the early 80s, David in particular noticed that he was meeting with a lot of clients and they didn't have broadly diversified exposure to small cap securities, or a lot of investors, I should say, because Dimensional wasn't in existence then. So a lot of investors, and thought, well, they have broadly diversified exposure to large cap US stocks. Why not small cap US stocks? Is there something that I can build such that can give them that kind of diversified exposure in a low turnover, low cost way? And so I think that was kind of listening to what our clients looking for in the marketplace, what do they need? And then having a set of investment principles. So you're not willing to build anything for anyone. It's having a set of investment principles to say, under these set of investment principles, here's how I can meet that need. So starting with client needs, I think, is very important into what solutions you're ultimately going to build. Then when you look at the investment principles themselves, I characterize them as three. One is that a rules-based approach is the right approach to investing, as long as you have the right pricing, the right support, the right innovation. So a rules-based approach, Alex, you know we work with organizations like your organization, where we can work with a financial professional like yourself, describe what the rules are in depth, so that you can set expectations appropriately about how one of our funds or ETFs or SMAs might work for your clients, and then slot it in the right place, and know that those set of rules are what are going to drive the outcomes that that portfolio is going to realize. So that means we can set the right expectations with the right client support, because that communication, education, and support that we provide financial professionals is very important. You have to have the right innovation. While you might believe in a rules-based approach for over 40 years, the rules tend to evolve over time as markets evolve. So you have to have the right innovation and the right pricing. So that's kind of, I would call it set number one or item number one. Item number two, we've mentioned this, security prices are forward-looking. The prices of stocks and bonds and options and so on are looking to the future. They're informed by the past, but look to the future. So you should use those prices in your investment process real time, all the time, so that you can improve returns or enhance your risk systems, right? So use stock, bond, options prices all the time in an intelligent way. And the third is optionality has value. We should capture it on behalf of clients. So that's about the flexibility. So if you're going to trade a particular security, if you have flexibility on how much to trade it and when to trade it, you're probably going to get better execution quality and leave less money on the table. So these are the types of insights. Those three insights, I think, have been at the firm since the founding and since the beginning. And they underpin a lot of how we approach investing. So Alex, you mentioned at the beginning, we have over $700 billion in assets now. So we invest in, you know, 45 different stock markets around the world, over 20 developed market bond markets around the world. We have a broad range of asset categories and solutions, but all built on those principles so that investment professionals like yourself can say, out of all these solutions, what can I pick that actually solves a need for my end investor? Because ultimately, that's what we're all here for, is how do we kind of create better outcomes in the future for the clients that we serve?
I've heard you and DFA in general make this distinction between passive investing and indexing. Would you talk about that?
My view on indexing is that the rules are too limited and too naive to really be able to capture all of the returns that markets have to offer. And so the way I often look at markets is that they're willing to pay you your fair share of the returns for the risks that you're willing to bear. But they're also willing to pay you far less. They pay you far less if you don't act intelligently when you're interacting with the markets. So when you look at indexing, there's some rules there that are somewhat, in my view, unnecessary if you're going to have a more involved approach or you're willing to put in the time to understand what it is the money manager is doing, right? So that is a trade-off. Indexing tends to be pretty transparent. And so you look at the index return, you look at your manager's return, you say they're the same or they're very similar. Okay, the manager did what they told me they would do. It doesn't mean that you understand what the index is doing well. So that's a separate one. And a lot of people don't do due diligence on their index providers, and they ought to. But that's a separate question. Our view is that if we have relationships with financial professionals, well, then we can have a much more involved rule set. For example, we don't have to wait for once or twice a year to rebalance a portfolio towards a particular asset category, like small caps. We can rebalance a little bit every day. That's just a smart thing to do. That means that if the small cap premium shows up, i.e. small caps outperform large caps on a given day, you're there to capture that premium. You can't predict when in advance it will show up, but if you only rebalance once a year or twice a year, well, then you're less likely to be well-positioned when it does show up rather than doing a little bit of rebalancing each and every day. Or if when you go to trade in the marketplace, do you trade in small quantities or very, very large quantities? Indexers tend to trade in very, very large quantities, very large percentages of the average daily volume on the days that they're turning over those indices, largely because there's so many assets tracking the indices. That means they have price pressure that's built into the index return itself. Why have that unnecessary price pressure? So our viewpoint is, if you're willing to understand the rules that we use to manage portfolios, you're willing to use indexes as kind of a guidepost on what market returns have been, but even there, it's a loose guidepost, and you're willing to spend the time with the manager, that you leave far less money on the table with a rules-based systematic approach that has a daily implementation than with an index approach. And I'll give you another example within small caps. So you mentioned we've been around for over 40 years. The very first mutual fund that we launched was the very first fund that we launched, very first strategy, was a small cap strategy. As I mentioned, David and Rex were looking to say, could we have a broadly diversified small cap strategy that complements the large cap strategy that some institutional asset owners owned? And if you look at that strategy, it's outperformed the Russell 2, so the only small cap index with a track record back to then, by about 1.5% difference in annualized compound return over that 40-year plus period. And we like to say, you know, when you look at investing and stock market returns have been about 10% annualized compound return historically. I don't know what they'll be in the future, but that's what they've been over the past 100 years. That's an explosive number because your money doubles every 7 years. Well, if you can take that 10 and turn it into an 11 or 12, your money doubles every 6. And at the end of a 40-year period, which is a typical accumulation phase for any investor, that's double the money. That is a really meaningful difference in standard of living that you can then afford in retirement. and you look at $100,000 invested in that microcap portfolio, you know, in the Russell 2, it would have grown to about $4 million in that portfolio, about between 8 and 9 after fees and expenses. And so that's the difference, right? So we think that indexing leaves too much money on the table, and it leaves it because you get a lot of transparency in how you monitor your manager. But we think that that little bit of extra effort to understand what your manager is doing, how they're innovating, how they're improving their strategies over time, that little bit of extra effort to understand your manager well pays off greatly over the long pull, because you leave the rigidities of indexing behind. And what I think is happening, we're seeing this more frequently, Alex, now, is we're seeing a lot of very large institutional asset owners kind of have gone to this model of, you know, cheap beta and then get your alpha in the private markets. And they've come back and realized that cheap beta has the word cheap in it for a reason, and that it hasn't delivered some of the results that they wanted. And I often compare it to, Alex, would you go out and find the cheapest sushi that you can find for your dinner? Most people say no, because they either like the taste of higher quality sushi, or they like the feeling of not eating very inexpensive sushi and having stomach indigestion or whatever it may be the next day. That's my view on investing. Why would you take something that's so important and say the expense ratio is the only decision point that you should consider? Because it's value for the fee that you've paid, not the lowest fee possible to pay. And I think that is something that we've been very adamant on for decades now. And you've seen the rise of indexing. I often say people have over-indexed on indexing. But I think that there's a very strong positive kind of swell towards other systematic approaches like our own, because the benefits of those have been demonstrated over many, many decades of real live market investing, real live market returns. And so I think that that case has been made very well by what's actually happened over the past 40 years.
The notion that you just walked through, that's something that I call structural alpha, meaning you can create excess returns by structuring your portfolio in a more thoughtful way, in a smarter way, based on data. And I think a lot of it leads to this recognition that the cost goes beyond the expense ratio, which is the cost that's published that you can quantify very easily. But the cost can go way beyond that. Would you dig into that a little bit more?
I think it's a good insight, Alex. And the structural alpha is, let's use an example, a real life example. So Tesla was added to the S&P 500 a couple of years ago. It was in December of that year, maybe 2022, in and around there. And if you look at Tesla in that month and the price of Tesla stock, on the day that it was added to the S&P 500, there was enormous buying demand for that stock. So it went up. And the day after it was added, that buying demand came down. So it came down. And so we have a strategy called a large company portfolio, which basically looks a lot like the S&P 500, but we don't do things at the same time as the S&P 500. And it outperformed by about 8 basis points, net of fees and expenses, the index in that 1 month, which is a reasonable estimate of how much it actually cost index trackers to add that stock in that month. That's built into the return of the S&P 500 index, by the way. So you could have matched the return of the S&P 500 index, but still borne 8 basis points in cost, in trading cost, to add the index in that 1 month. That's an estimate. It's not a bad estimate, but it's an estimate. It's not perfect, it's an estimate. When you look at the expense ratios for S&P 500 funds, they're a handful of basis points. So in 1 month, you could estimate that 3 or 4 times the expense ratio, the annual expense ratio, was spent to add a stock to the index. Now, it cost that much because everybody wanted to do it at the same time, because it was being added to the index at that time. And if zero tracking error is your objective, then you're going to have to do it at the same time as everybody else. That's why the cost was high. And the market will step up and provide all that abnormal liquidity, but it demands to be compensated for providing that service to folks who want to consume that service. So you could say, what's a structural alpha? Well, don't trade at the same time that everybody else is trying to acquire a stock. That's an example of using flexibility to then not pay the same costs as others. And that's one example in a trading perspective where it's kind of very obvious that you can see that structural example. But there's other structural examples, I would contend, Alex, and this is where we think financial professionals like yourselves are important, because what's risk to one person may not be risk to another person or as risky to another person. And that all depends on what that person's goals are. And so in working with financial professionals, we think that families, moms and pops, can better identify what their goals are. And if you can identify what your goals are, you can then come up with what are the truly risk mitigating assets with respect to those goals. And those are the things that reduce my uncertainty with respect to your goals. And that allows me to more efficiently put capital to work for achieving your goals and take on the risky part of your portfolio. And so that's another type of what I would call structural alpha, that we work a lot with financial professionals to understand what are the different types of goals that investors are saving for. And then can we build the tools? And we view that our tools have expected outperformance or alpha relative to index-based approaches. But then if used in the right way by a financial professional, then they have expected outperformance versus some naive approach who's not, the person who's not starting with their goals and building an allocation that's really designed around an investor's goals. So there's lots of ways to look at investing where I think that if you don't have the expertise, there's potential to leave money on the table, whether it's through the individual funds that you're using to implement the asset allocation or the goals and the, how that informs the asset allocation itself. I think that there's a lot to this kind of structural kind of notion on giving investors better outcomes, ultimately by listening, understanding what it is that investors are acquiring and then building the best tools and putting them in the right place to meet those outcomes for investors.
The other way I know you try to add value in your portfolios is by understanding that securities have different expected returns, you know, both stocks and bonds. And you've talked about that a little bit. Would you describe that in more detail and how you construct portfolios with that notion?
We think that, and I think most everybody I've ever asked agrees with this statement, that there are differences in expected returns across stocks and across bonds. Not all stocks have the same expected return. An expected return is different than realized return, because we all know that there's differences in realized return. But investors demand higher returns to hold some stocks than others, right? And that can be seen right now. The Mag 7 had a big run-up in price, and maybe that's due to the fact that their expected cash flows to shareholders increased over the past year. But it may also be because the investors demand a lower return right now to hold those stocks. So certain stocks we think have higher expected returns, certain stocks lower. Same with bonds. Some bonds have higher expected returns, some bonds have lower expected returns. And the question then we ask ourselves is, can we use that information in a systematic way such that we can build portfolios that are like the market so that you get market rates of return, because we know the market is a good place to be, whether it's the broad stock market or the broad bond market, but then put you in a position to earn more than market rates of return. So diversification is important, low cost is important, low turnover is important. And the way that we do that is you can describe it in different ways, whether it's factor-based investing, whether it's systematic investing. But effectively, how I think about it is combining stock and bond prices each day with other measures of firm size to say, here today, who in the stock market has been assigned a low price and who a high price? Because the lower the price that you pay for something, all else equal, the higher the expected return. If you have two investments, each expected to pay you $100 a year from now, and one you can buy for $10, and one you can buy for $99, well, they're each expected to give you $100, but the one with $10 has a higher expected return, all else equal, right? And so the way that we do it is we scale price in different ways. So the size premium, the excess return of small caps over big cap stocks. Basically, you're normalizing price by multiplying it by shares outstanding. The value premium, low relative price versus high relative price, or value versus growth. You're taking price and you're dividing it by some other fundamental measure of firm size to say, here's low price relative to something. Profitability. Profitability predicts future cash flows to investors. So you're combining that with the prices that people are willing to pay for what they're expecting to receive. So all in all, what you're trying to do is find low discount rate stocks, whether that's size, value, profitability. And that's how we inform our asset allocation within within the stocks that we select, is we want to have a greater than market weight in stocks with smaller market capitalization that have lower relative prices and higher expected profitability, because we think those have higher expected returns in the market. And then kind of in contrast to that, lower than market weight in high price stocks that are very, very mega cap with low profitability. That type of asset allocation is then how you take the market and shift the market to something that we think puts you in the position of having higher than market rates of return. But even if those premiums turn out to be zero over the next 10 or 20 years, i.e. value stocks return the same as growth stocks over the next 20 years, you still end up with market rates of return, right? So put you in the position to have higher market rates of return, take that 10 and turn it into an 11 or 12. But if the 11 and 12 doesn't show up, make sure you get that 10. And I think that's the way that we've generally approached investing. Some people call that factor investing, where it's size factor, value factor, profitability factor. Other people call it systematic, where you're systematically using information and prices and complementing it with other pieces of information that you have about the firm so that you can categorize stocks by their expected return more or less into the high and low and market-like, and using that information to systematically, in a, as I said, diversified, low turnover fashion, shift weight away from the low expected return stocks in the market to the high expected return stocks. And that's what we do across the equity side. And we do very similar things on the fixed income. You give us an asset category, we're trying to manage risk better, but then we're trying to overweight those stocks, our bonds, with higher expected returns.
I have two questions on that point. The first is, how do you deal with market cyclicality and the risk that you can go through a long period of time where, you know, the market earns 10, but you might earn 7 because those factors just were unfavorable or just didn't, you know, experience the same tailwind as maybe the rest of the market, and the risk that investors lose patience and faith that it works over time when that period lasts a long time? How do you deal with that?
So I think that you have to identify that right up front for investors. Because if you take a strategy like what we typically call core equity market or a core market type strategy, so market type of a strategy, it's not impossible, but very unlikely that you get that type of an outcome over 10 or 20 years, in particular if you invest globally, right? And so for that type of a strategy, it's not deviating from the market by so much that that outcome is very likely. That type of outcome tends to be more likely when you deviate from the market by a lot. Now, why would you deviate from market by a lot? Well, you might do that because you want even higher expected outperformance. But you have to know and recognize up front that there's the chance of greater underperformance if that does indeed occur. So I think having that conversation, understanding of the end client up front to understand what their tolerances are, that helps you arrive at the right asset allocation. Because if even, you know, over the past 10 or 20 years, there's a lot of talk about value and small value underperforming. That's largely based by the US observation. In the US, we've had uncharacteristically high average returns for large growth stocks. So not very low returns for large value or small value stocks. Their returns have been quite strong, but uncharacteristically high average returns for large growth. And that's a US phenomenon. So large value, small value has done what is expected, but large growth has done better than expected. You outside the US, you don't see that. Over the past 10 or 20 years, you see strong outperformance for small value versus large growth. So even with that observation here in the US, if you had a globally balanced portfolio, you're not really in that situation as if you had a US and you went 50% small value, 50% large caps, right? Then that type of a level of a deviation from the market would lead to that outcome. So I think that's important. It's understanding what the investor is sensitive to, being upfront about how bad it can be so that there's no surprises, about how bad it can be, but then being clear on we're taking that level of deviation because maybe your investment horizon is X long, or you're not sensitive to tracking error versus the broad market, or you want those higher expected returns because it doesn't come without risk, but that the payoff is there. The other piece though, Alex, and this is kind of a more fundamental piece, people talk about cycles all the time, but cycles don't actually exist. They're not supported by the data in any way, shape or form. And what do I mean by that? Cycles are something that we've constructed by the way that we plot data. So people will plot a rolling 20-year return and say, look at these cycles. Well, when you plot a rolling 20-year return, you've built in massive what they call autocorrelation into the data, because the next month that you've plotted has 19 years and 11 months in common with the previous month that you just plotted the data point. So you're basically plotting the same data point over and over and over and over and over and over again. So market cycles don't actually exist. We plot them and pretend they exist, but they don't exist. When you look at the data itself, what you find is there's very little autocorrelation in the data. Last month's returns tell you almost nothing about what next month's returns will be. Last year's returns tell you almost nothing about what next year's returns will be. And then when you look at what people categorize as a cycle, it's usually where you've gone from, like at a calendar year, 52% winning rate to a 48% winning rate. For example, value versus growth over the past couple of decades. There's been tons of years when value outperformed growth, and some years when growth outperformed value, but growth outperformed value by more. So I think that's the other piece to keep in mind. A lot of folks focus on cycles, and I understand why, because you have an experience of this was my return over the past 20 years, but it's one point. And so the reason that I bring up that point is because people often focus on cycles as a way to predict what's going to happen next. And the point that I'm making is that it gives you no ability to predict what's going to happen next. And it gives you it shouldn't be your expectation that you should go to a value cycle or a growth cycle, because there's no autocorrelation in the premium data. The observation this month tells you nothing about what's going to happen next month.
The second question on that topic relates to this notion of market efficiency. How do you think about the possibility or the risk that when you look backwards and you study the data, that the market adapts to that data? So if there's a premium for value versus growth or a premium for small versus large, is there a risk that premium evaporates in the future as market participants become knowledgeable of that and then price that in? How do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a very important question, and it goes into how do you do the research? And I think that a part of it is what's the phenomenon that you're identifying with your piece of research? Because the research shouldn't be done to explain historical returns. It should be done to predict future returns. So let's take the example of size, value, profitability. For me, they're all a discount rate effect. They're basically saying, where can I identify the stocks where the market has applied a higher discount rate to future cash flows versus stocks that the market has applied a lower discount rate to future cash flows? I won't ever know all the reasons why the market applied a higher discount rate to the future cash flows of stock A versus stock B. I'll never be able to understand that reason. I can speculate and I can come up with very plausible answers, but I'll never be able to understand that reason. But do I expect all stocks to have the same expected return going forward? No. I don't think that state of the world is very likely. And so therefore, when I look back at those types of premiums and you say, what has to change? Basically, the main thing that has to change is that investors demand the same expected return to hold every stock, regardless of what that stock is. And I think that's a highly unlikely state of the world. So you say, okay, I look back historically at the data and size, value, profitability. I can pursue those with very low turnover portfolios, like let's call it 10%, 15% turnover in a given year. I can pursue those with very diversified portfolios. They can hold many thousands of securities. I can pursue those globally. And I can pursue those with a reasonably low-cost portfolio with good, solid implementation, whether it's how you keep yourself focused on the premiums or how you keep yourself or your trading costs, things of that nature. And then you say, okay, for those premiums, I think it's worth pursuing because it goes back to the point that I made earlier on. The opportunity cost is small. Because if those premiums, let's pretend that they weren't there because of risk. And let's pretend that going forward, the market says every stock has the same expected return. It doesn't matter what's going on with that security. Even if that security has some terrible news happening with it right now, and it looks like that stock may not exist, we're still going to apply the same expected return for holding that stock. Let's just pretend that unlikely state of the world happens. You end up with a good portfolio. You end up with a market portfolio. There's other observations, though, that you say that may not be the outcome. The example that we often use is momentum. There's no really good reason why you should expect to see momentum in the data. Why is a stock that has just gone up in price over the past few months now have a lower discount rate applied to it than one that has just gone down in price? I don't know, but momentum is the tendency of stocks that have just gone up in price over the past 3 to 12 months to continue to do so relative to the market over the next, 3 months or so. So there, what we say is, how can we use that information in a way that does no harm? And we delay the purchase of stocks that are in downward momentum and delay the sales of stocks in upward momentum. So that we get a part of the premium without incurring costs to pursue it. So I think that your question is a really important one, because the historical data tells you that there have been premiums, that they happen by more than just chance, right? That's part of the testing. This happened by a lot more than just chance. So you might want to expect it going forward. But then you should take that information and say, how do I build a portfolio around this that is still a good strategy, even if those premiums are zero in the future? And that's the question that we ask ourselves all the time, is that, and that's what I mentioned at the start, models are very, very helpful to understand the data, but don't ever pretend that the models give you the perfect solution to anything. It's, yes, the model gives you an understanding, but then it's the art of the science. How do you build something that's robust? And I think that's a very important question for managers to ask themselves because of what you mentioned, because you don't know what these premiums will be. Even if the market, there are value premiums over the next, on expectation, you can go through long time periods when they don't show up. And so I think that's an important question to ask for portfolio design purposes.
And obviously, you're constantly testing the data. So it's not like you tested it 40 years ago and you haven't looked at it since. You're looking at it every day, every second. And if things look like they're actually changing and there's data support for that change and you understand why that change is occurring, obviously that would get implemented as well.
100%. Like when profitability came along about 10 years ago, we realized that we could replace, we were using earnings price, cash flow to price in some of our processes. We realized that we could replace those variables with profitability, and that we had a better description of differences in expected returns. When you look on the bond side, there's been a lot of evolution in bond markets over time, in particular about their transparency and the pricing that you have. So we realized that we could do real-time credit monitoring using bond prices over time that could enhance the strategies. So that is taking prices from lots of different sources, so that we can actually assign real-time credit ratings that complement the rating agency credit ratings to thousands of bonds throughout the day, that type of scale. Or if you look at how we trade, that has evolved over time as market microstructures have changed. Or accounting practices, we've changed the way that we measure certain variables over time. So that's what the rules-based approach, in my view, is a good approach to investing. But Alex, to your point, innovation has to happen. And part of innovation is introspection, is saying, this is the way that I have been doing it. Is this still the best way that I know how to do it, given that I know more today than I did 5 years ago? So introspection is a very important part of innovation. And then talking to clients and understanding their needs is another important part of innovation, because I've learned more in the past 5 years. So the needs that I hear from my clients, I can probably more address in a more systematic fashion than I could in the past. So both of those are real key inputs into innovation. And in my view, if you're not asking your manager how they're innovating and how they're learning and how they're improving, you're kind of missing something there, because it's an important way to learn more about your manager's commitment to that way of investing and their commitment to serving clients well.
And that recognition, I believe, is crucial, because the markets are constantly evolving. The investors are getting smarter. They're learning from historical experiences. There's new insight about the future, and that is gets reflected in market pricing. And so if you are too dogmatic about your approach and you don't evolve, you can effectively be left behind.
I agree. And that is, again, Alex, why I think indexing is also something that leaves money on the table, because you basically delegate asset allocation as a money manager to a third party. And that third party may not have the real-time insights that you have and that you're gaining from working in markets each and every day. And they're also not talking to the end investors on an ongoing basis and the financial professionals on an ongoing basis to understand what problems it is they're experiencing. And they may not be doing the same level of rigorous research that an organization like Dimensional prides itself on doing, or the same connections with academia. We think the combination of all of those things is an important component to getting the right solutions in the hands of financial professionals to serve their end investors.
I'd like to ask you a moment about private markets relative to public markets. We talked about public markets being relatively efficient. Is your sense that there's more alpha opportunity in private markets, as obviously a lot of money has flown in that direction?
Whenever I'm asked a question like that, it's always, I go back to what I can say from the data. And the challenge with answering that question is that the private market data is not as rich as public market data and makes that question very challenging to answer. So we've done a lot of experiments with private market data here at Dimensional. And so we've, you know, gathered data from organizations like Burgess and Preqin and so on. And the things that we can say are that if you look at the dispersion among private market managers, whether it's in private equity or venture capital or private credit or private real estate, that the dispersion of returns tends to be very high. And so depending on the fund and the vintage that you invest in, there can be a large dispersion in returns. And that's something that should be considered when investing and selecting a private market manager, because you could end up with a great outcome or a very, very poor outcome. So that has to be acknowledged, that there's a wide range of outcomes that are possible. The second observation is that private markets probably add some diversification to your portfolio. And if you look, I'll just focus on private equity for a moment. If you look at private equity and investable private equity, and you look at reasonable estimates of investable private equity, now, I'm not talking about all private companies, I'm talking about the ones that you can actually invest in as an investor, that was at about 6 or 7% of the size of the public markets for a long period of time. And more recently, it's climbed up to as high as 10, in and around there. I'm using rough numbers. And so that tells you that there's a lot of companies out there that you don't hold in your public market solutions, right? In your public market portfolios. And those companies can provide nice diversification if you can get a diversified exposure at an appropriate cost. And you see that in the returns of private market managers. When you look and you look at things like correlations, although they're not perfect, you see diversification benefits to broad exposure to private markets. So I think that's a potential benefit. On the alpha question, you don't see as much on the alpha question at all. And that's because the returns are more challenging to benchmark. So let's unpack that a little bit. The way the private market managers report returns is not the same as public market managers, where in the public markets, a mutual fund or an ETF, it has an NAV every single day. And it's based on largely market prices, mark to market every single day. And you get a daily return every single day in real time, all the time for most mutual funds and ETFs. That's reported to everyone, so you get to see it as it happens. There's no hiding, and that allows you to compute returns in a particular way. When you're looking at things like IRRs and other types of ways that private market investments, the returns are reported, it makes that comparison to public market returns much more challenging. But what we've typically found is that a lot of reported alpha disappears as soon as you benchmark to more appropriate public market benchmarks. And so I think that's, I'm using that as a kind of the broad distribution. I'm not saying that there's not private market managers that have done very well and some that have done very poorly. I'm just saying the broad distribution looks like there's, the alpha is not robust when you benchmark it in the right way. So from a returns perspective, I typically don't weigh in on the returns too much because the data don't allow you to say too much. And what I will say is that I think due diligence is incredibly important if you're going to work with a private market manager. Pricing is incredibly important. So what's the way that you're going to get charged? If you can get diversification, I think that's an important thing to emphasize. So all of those things could lead to some kind of rationale for why private market solutions in your portfolio. The alpha part, though, that is probably a little bit of the due diligence and a little bit of a leap of faith, I would say, because it's particularly hard to say in the broad distribution, whether the broad distribution is actually, if I pick one at random, then the data suggests that you're probably not getting alpha to the appropriate benchmark in the public market. And then the question you have to ask yourself is, am I doing better than picking at random when I'm picking a private market manager? I think that's the way I generally think about private market investing. And it certainly has become more popular over time. There's been a lot of cash flows that way for lots of different reasons that we probably no time to get into on this webinar. But I would say that if you're going to invest that way, it's important to work with a financial professional. It's important to do your due diligence, and it's important to know what you're getting into and what to expect. Those things are very important.
I suppose if you have broader dispersion across managers in private markets than you do potentially in public markets, there is theoretically more alpha potential. But you obviously need some alpha in finding the managers who have that potential and doing the underwriting and due diligence. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, there's potential to be, I don't know if it's surprised on the upside as well as surprised on the downside, or skill at identifying the upside or identifying the downside. I really don't know if it's one or the other. But as I said, you know, it's kind of the question you really have to ask yourself is, if that skill exists, why are they willing to share it with you after their fees and expenses? Because ultimately, you know, a lot of private markets, and it's not all, but a lot, you know, you take a company from the public market into the private market, you think that you can add some skill or you can add some value to that company after it's been private, and then you exit by selling it to another private market manager or back into the public markets. So you're coming out and going in at public market valuations, and you're hopeful that along the way, through your own Rolodex or your own skill set, that you can make the, as a private market manager, make that company more valuable. And then the question is, why would that person who can do that share that skill with you as the end investor? Because your cash is probably not the scarce resource there. That private market manager's skill, if it is indeed skill, is probably the scarce resource. So why do they share it with you? And I think that's the important question as you're doing your due diligence that you have to ask yourself, debt and fees and expenses, do I think that this is the right solution? The diversification question, though, is not nearly as involved. That one for me is, can I get 200, 300, 400 different private market companies in my private market portfolio at a reasonable cost? If I can do that, that has a diversification benefit that I think is more obvious, a more obvious benefit for an end investor.
Let's talk about building a diversified portfolio. Would you talk about your framework for building both a well-diversified portfolio across assets, and then also perhaps talk about how to build diversification within a bond portfolio or a stock portfolio?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there it starts with the goals and understanding what it is that person is saving for, understanding their other assets. What do I mean by that? Let's say you have a person who's kind of early in their career. Well, they have a lot of income from their human capital going forward. And so you might say that most of their wealth today is in their human capital, and what their human capital is going to translate into actual, physical, tangible wealth in the future. So understanding that about a person, and then that kind of allows you to arrive at what's an appropriate asset allocation given their risk tolerance between either what assets you consider less risky and assets that you consider more risky. So that is often the stock bond mix. What are they saving for? Are they saving for retirement? Are they saving for their kids' college? Are they saving for something else? I think that also helps you identify what assets reduce uncertainty relative to what it is they're actually saving for. And then that helps you identify the risk reduction versus the risky assets. And you allocate the risky assets usually because you can't meet your goals with your own saving, right? So you're willing to take some risk to grow the value of your wealth to meet your investment goals. That's why you take risk. If you could do that without having to take any risk, you just construct whatever is the riskless asset for you and invest all your money in that because you can meet all your goals. Why take any risk if you don't have to? So I think that's an important part. So when you look at diversification there, it's that split between, you know, stocks, bonds, maybe something like REITs, other types of asset categories like that. Then within bonds, I think you start, in my view, you start with the broad market and you decide why you're different. And the same within stocks, you start with the broad market and decide why you're different. The broad market in bonds, you have many yield curves around the world. You have bonds issued in US dollars, in British pounds, in euros, in Aussie dollars, in Swiss franc. You have bonds issued in lots of different currencies. You can hedge out the currency exposure if you choose, but that gives you diversification across currency of issuance. It also allows you to say, okay, if I want a broadly diversified bond portfolio, I have treasuries, I have corporates, I have bonds that are related to mortgages. So again, looking for value add in each one of those asset categories, but building yourself a broadly diversified portfolio of bonds, I think is appropriate. Other reasons why you might be different is if you want something that has a lot of certainty with respect to the value of your wealth, then you have to go short duration, high quality. If you want expected returns only and you're willing to put up with some volatility, then it's a more of a core-like broad market bond offering. If you have liabilities that are very long dated, then you maybe want to go long duration to match the duration of your liability. So those will inform why you might be different than the market. On the equity side, again, start with the whole stock market, in my view, which is 45 countries around the world, 10,000 plus individual stocks around the world. And with that, I'd say how different are you willing to be? And then build a portfolio that overweights smaller cap value, profitability, so that you're willing to take on some differences versus the broad market in the pursuit of higher expected returns. That doesn't mean that you don't hold all those stocks. You can hold a strategy with all of those stocks, and we have many that hold many thousands of securities, so they're broadly diversified, but deviate from the market in order to increase returns. So I think it starts off with investor goals and risk preferences and risk tolerances. That kind of gives you a broad view of what are the appropriate bonds for those goals? What's the split between stocks and bonds for those goals? And then build diversification into each of those strategies once you've decided on what's appropriate for the end investor.
Makes a lot of sense. One observation that I've had the last several years is investors, particularly the clients, the people's money that we're all investing, they tend to chase returns. And, you know, for the last almost 10 plus years, the S&P 500 has done really well. You know, big cap tech has done really well. And portfolios, in my observation, are less diversified today than they were 10 years ago because investors are flocking towards the things that have done really well. How do you think about that? And are there any important lessons you'd like to share?
Yeah, let's take the S&P 500, since you mentioned that one as the example. And if you look coming towards the end of last year, you had close on 30% of the weight of that index in about 10 stocks, right? So that's higher than it has been in the past. Now, we've had situations 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago where the S&P 500 has looked like that. Now, if that was all you had to invest in, I'd say that's appropriate diversification. 30% of your weight in 10 stocks, that's all you have to invest in. Okay, that's appropriate diversification. But it's not all you have to invest in. You have small cap stocks within the US. You have even some large cap stocks in the US. I think this is a funny fact. If you look at the top 500 stocks and which of those are in the S&P 500, there's about $2 trillion of market cap, bigger than the whole Australian market cap of stocks in the top 500 that are not in the S&P 500. Because the S&P 500 is... Yeah, again, it's important to understand the rules. The rules are not just market cap. There's other selection criteria that qualifies a stock for it. So there's even other large cap stocks that are not in the S&P 500 that you might want to include, US small cap stocks, then the stocks of non-US developed market countries, the stocks of emerging market countries. So if you go from that S&P 500 viewpoint of the world and say 30% in 10 names, that's, you know, okay, that's what that is. And then you go to a globally diversified view with overweights to small and value and profitability. Now you're down to about 10% of your stock portfolio in the top 10 names. Which one sounds better? Well, the 10% in the top 10 names, I think, well, I'm less likely to be negatively impacted by the fortunes of 10 specific companies. And I think that's just a basic tenet of diversification. So, you know, markets will ebb and flow. The makeup across market cap of securities will ebb and flow across time. And it's always a game of what's the alternative? Because there's nothing in absolute. So it's always relative to something else. So what's the alternative to the S&P 500? A globally diversified portfolio of stocks. And the immediate benefit is you lower your concentration risk immediately by moving from that to the other alternative. Does the S&P 500 have a higher expected return going forward than everybody else in the world? That's unlikely. And all you have to look at is the last decade here in the US, where people were basically saying, you know, where the US and large cap stocks in the US had the lowest returns, and developed markets next, and emerging markets next, and small caps next. So it was the exact opposite of this decade that we've just been through. So it's one of those things where you can't be so myopic and try out common sense for 10 years worth of data. Unfortunately, even though 10 years seems like a long time, it's actually quite a small amount of data to draw any type of strong inference from. And that's something that a lot of people have a hard time kind of wrapping their minds around, because 10 years seems like a long time to most people, but it's just a blink in the eye when it really comes to investing.
Yeah, in the real world, 10 years is a long time, but in the investment world, it's very short. DFA has made a significant move into ETFs. Would you talk about that and what has driven that focus?
Yeah, again, it comes back to some of the things I mentioned earlier on about working with clients and understanding what are the needs of our clients, and then also understanding how markets are changing. So in 2019, the SEC brought in a new rule called the ETF rule. And before that, the way that ETFs were managed is different than today in the sense of, and I don't want to get into so much of the specifics, but the rule basically allowed active ETFs, so non-index-based ETFs, to be much better managed than prior to the rule. And that's to do with how ETFs interact with authorized participants, so what they call the create and redeem process, how new ETF shares are created, and then how ETF shares are taken off the market, right? So that's basically, there was a change that enabled a much more efficient approach to managing a non-index-based strategy in an ETF wrapper. We had been hearing from the financial professionals that we worked with that they wanted more choice in vehicle to consume Dimensional's investment approach. They didn't want to sacrifice anything in the investment approach when it came to the choice of vehicle. And the ETF rule allowed us to deliver that. Basically, we could take an investment approach that we had been kind of honing and developing for very large separate accounts, for mutual funds for four decades, and apply that investment approach in an ETF wrapper in what the SEC deems active transparent. So I basically call it non-index transparent, a way of investing. We're able to bring that to the table. And it's just worked out tremendously well for the financial professionals we work with, their clients, and Dimensional. So it's been kind of a win-win all around. Because we listen to the folks that we work with, understand what their needs were, and then we're able to launch strategies that met their needs. So within 3 years, just a little over 3 years, we're already at 130 billion assets under management in ETF, in the ETF wrapper. We're by AUM across the full suite, we have 38 ETFs. We're the largest active transparent ETF manager in the US in just 3 years. So we think that we understood the need well and met the need well of the financial professionals that we work with. And we're able to deliver an investment approach such that whether it's the expense ratios, because sister ETFs and mutual funds, we've worked to have very similar expense ratios. The investment approach, sister ETFs and mutual funds, a very similar investment approach. And a tax profile, actually, that we've been able to accomplish with our mutual funds and our ETFs, very similar tax profile or tax efficiency ratios. So basically, we want to take all those off the table so financial professionals can choose the vehicle that's right for them, whether it's a mutual fund, an SMA, or an ETF. You choose the vehicle, you can get a very similar investment approach and overall investment experience, regardless of the vehicle wrapper. And we've been able to accomplish that working well with the financial professionals and other institutions over that time period. So it's been a real, I would call it, success story. We're very pleased with how that's come out. The regulations changed. We understood a need in the marketplace. We said, here's how we can build a value-add solution better than anything else that we see out there. And then the outcome that you see 3 years later is kind of the proof of getting that right.
That's great. We're running out of time. There's one last topic that I wanted to ask you about. Given that you're a data scientist and the hot topic these days is artificial intelligence, AI, and you've been working on that long before it became mainstream, how do you foresee the impact on your investment process and just the industry in general?
Yeah, I think that there's a few different ways of describing it. One that we often like to say, and I got this one from Professor Bob Merton, is we shouldn't call it artificial intelligence, we should call it assisted implementation. Because I think that is the real power of what a lot of the tools that have been developed over the past many decades and will continue to be developed bring to the table. And so they allow you to be more efficient in how you implement a strategy, more efficient in how you understand the data. I don't think they're going to give you any different insights in mispricing. They're not going to allow you to outguess market prices, because guess what? As soon as you have better information and you trade upon it, everybody has that information because you just traded upon it. And that goes to your point, Alex, where the tools and that people use and the infrastructure changes over time. So markets get better over time. And I think that AI will probably lead to some innovations that will help markets become more efficient to run over time. And the more efficient to run, the lower the cost they are to run. And therefore, the better and more smoothly they would run on expectation. So the way I think about it is, it's very important for organizations like Dimensional to understand what those tools can bring to the table, how we can gain efficiencies ourselves as an organization, such that then as we become more efficient, how do we pass on those cost savings to the end investors? And so it's an aspect of whether we use it on the research side of things, whether we use it on how we implement the strategies day in, day out, how we service our clients. All of those things, I think, will lead to efficiencies. And I think that's really where the big gains come from. I think that some people focus too much on certain companies because if there's tools that enable productivity across companies in the marketplace, then all of those companies get lifted up. So, for example, the internet many, many years ago, there was tools that came to the table. And you didn't have to invest in just internet stocks to benefit from the productivity that things like a Google search enabled organizations to have. So that from an investment perspective, I think that invest in the markets. And if AI is really something very, very important and helps people become more efficient and helps people become more productive, then market prices will be lifted up across the board. And you don't have to identify just the companies associated with delivering AI tools to actually have a good experience from it. So as an individual, learn from the tools, develop your skill set, and then as an investor, invest in the broad markets. And I think that you'll be okay with respect to the innovations that AI will bring.
That's great. Gerard, I appreciate your time and for sharing your insights with us today. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Alex, for having me on the show, and good conversation, and appreciate the questions and all you do for your clients, and appreciate the relationship that we have with our two organizations.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit our website at insightfulinvestor.org to access past shows and learn more about our podcast. If you have questions, feel free to email us at info@insightfulinvestor.org. And if you enjoyed the discussion, please subscribe to this podcast to ensure you don't miss future episodes. And don't forget to forward today's conversation to others you think would enjoy listening.
This podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Evoke Advisors, their affiliates, or companies featured. Due to industry regulations, participants on this podcast are instructed not to make specific trade recommendations, nor reference past or potential profits. And listeners are reminded that securities trading, commodity trading, and alternative investments are complex and carry a risk of substantial losses. As such, they are not suitable for all investors.
Listeners should be aware that guests featured on The Insightful Investor may have current or past associations with Evoke Advisors or the host, including as an investment manager of a private fund opportunity by Evoke, or access through an affiliated Evoke fund, or as a client. Participation as a guest on the podcast should not be perceived as an endorsement or testimonial with respect to Evoke Advisors, the podcast host, or their services. Similarly, the inclusion of a guest on the podcast does not imply that Evoke Advisors or the host endorses the guest or any company with which they may be affiliated or employed. Evoke has neither paid nor received compensation from guests for their participation.